Was everyone this morning? Oh, good and excellent. This side, not so good. I'm okay. A little chilly. After a month and a half in the States, I'm still wearing a jacket. But it's good to be here this morning. And I've got my water here in case I need it, which I won't if I get it. But if I don't, I'll need it. This morning, first I'd like to start off with a question. Why do you think the Bible is mostly story? People like to hear a story. That's a good one. And that is definitely true. In fact, the Bible's about 75% story. You know, the majority of it. Another roughly 15% is poetry, and about 10% is what we in the Church of Christ like instructional, doctrinal statements and such. It's only about 10%. Can everyone hear me fine? Okay. So why? Why is it mostly story? And I don't think it's because God wants us to dissect the story, analyze it, and then we come up with our doctrinal points from the analysis of the story. I think that it is mostly story because when we get into a story, and I mean emotionally connected into a story, we feel what the characters in the story felt, and we have the same, you know, anger and frustration or happiness or whatever it is in the story. When we feel that, when we get into that story, then I think that we can travel the path that we see in the story, and I think that's how our lives are going to change. And I think that's what it means when we say we want to make the Bible relevant. Because I think we want people to connect emotionally with the story. So today, my goal today is to help you to feel, to help you to get into the story and feel what they felt, and then hopefully you can travel the path that's revealed in the story. And first, a little background. I think a lot of times we read a story in the Bible or we hear a story in the Bible and we can't connect to it because we are modern Americans and this story was written 2,000 years ago to people in a different country, in a different culture, in a different situation. So a little background, and the basic background I think of even a lot of the Bible is the kind of the cycle of history. If you look at history, especially in the Old Testament, we see this cycle of history that just continues going. And you start out with freedom, where freedom reigns. People are healthy and wealthy, and things are going well. And for whatever reason, that freedom kind of disintegrates and decays into corruption and oppression. So you got, I guess, freedom, and then the freedom is corrupted. And then you've got oppression, poverty. You know, this is when the Assyrians come in, where you're in war and civil war. And then out of that chaos comes more, you know, another cycle, another period of freedom. And we can see that with Moses, where, you know, the children of Israel are in oppression. Moses comes, he brings them into this period of freedom, and that, the history of Israel just continues, you know. The book of Judges, you see like seven different cycles of this, I think. You know, they're oppressed for a time, and then a judge comes in and kind of brings them back some self-rule to their country, more honesty and openness and righteousness come in, and so they're free for a period of time, and then corruption, idolatry comes back in, and they go through this cycle. And eventually you get to David. Saul and King David kind of bring in a new golden age for the people of Israel. And as soon as Solomon is gone, you know, it just kind of corruption comes in again. And by the time we get to our story today, we're in the full-on oppression where King Ahab is in charge of Israel. He's gotten a foreign wife that's come in and basically is running the country in place of the king. And she's very oppressive to the Israelites and trying to find all the prophets and kill all of the prophets of Yahweh that are in Israel. And so it's a very dark time. And our hero comes in. Hero for the day comes in at this time, in the reign of King Ahab. Our hero is named Elijah. He is someone who is nothing like I am, maybe nothing like a lot of us. He's very radical. He obeys God in every way, even if it means danger and suffering. He's constantly challenging the status quo. He's constantly speaking against the government. He seems absolutely fearless in the face of terrible odds. He's faithful. He's confident. And so he's not much like me. And he, a lot of times, seems like a superhero. You know, he's creating all these, or he's doing all these miracles. He's coming in. He has no concern for danger or what might happen in the future. And so when Elijah comes on the scene, he goes to Ahab. He prophesies to Ahab. He says, "There will not be any rain in Israel until I say so. There's going to be famine until I say so. Not even any dew on the ground until I say so." And it happened. There were 3 years in Israel where it did not rain a drop. And Elijah lives in exile in a foreign country, living in poverty with a widow and her son, you know, living off of the miraculous oil and flour that they pour it and it never runs dry, and they continue to live like that for a while. And while he's living with this widow, her son dies. And Elijah, at this time, prays to God. And listen to the words of the prayer that he prayed. He said, "Oh God, my God, why have you brought this terrible thing on this widow who has opened her home to me? Why have you killed her son?" And then Elijah prays for the son to live again, and the son is raised from the dead, lives again. Wow. And that's just kind of the prologue to the next part of the story, the famous showdown on Mount Carmel that we've probably heard 1,000 sermons on already. Where after 3 years, Elijah goes back to Israel, confronts Ahab, who is not happy with him, to say the least. And they go up on the mountain, and you know, Elijah says, "Okay, you Baal prophets, you build your altar to Baal, and you pray to Baal, and he'll send down fire or not. And then I'll pray to Yahweh in my altar, and he'll send down fire, and we'll see whose God is the real God. We'll see who the righteous, the right God is." And he stands out there all day long with thousands of people around him who are all against him. He's all alone up there taunting their Baal prophets as they cry out and cut themselves to get their God's attention so that he might send a spark down. And he taunts them all day long, fearlessly. At the end of the day, they've given up, I suppose. And Elijah says a simple prayer, you know, flames come down from heaven, consume the offering, the altar, everything around there, and all the people who are, who until this time have been pretty passive in allowing this Baal worship to come in, been passive in allowing Jezebel to run their country, they all just fall down on their faces and they say, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." And this is about where most sermons on Elijah end, in my experience. But I don't think this is the end of the story, not even by a long shot. So today you get the rest of the story. I'm going to do a Paul Harvey on you. So after all these people, you know, bow down and worship God, "Oh, the Lord is God, the Lord is God," Elijah and all these people, they become this like lynch mob, and they grab all the Baal prophets. They take them down the mountain in the valley, and they just kill them all, murder them all in the valley. And Elijah says to Ahab, "You need to go back to town because it's about to rain." And you know, you realize that it hasn't rained for three years, and he said, "It's not going to rain until I say it's going to rain." Well, now he's saying it. And as he's saying it, there's a cloud coming in, you know, and so Ahab goes back to town in his chariot to avoid the storm, apparently, and Elijah runs faster than the chariot all the way back to town. And so another question I have is, what is Elijah expecting or hoping at this point? What is Elijah? I mean, what's got him so excited that he's running faster than a chariot all the way back to town? What does he think he's going to see when he gets back to town? I think he is expecting change. I think he's expecting justice and freedom to begin to reign. I think he's expecting regime change, a new government to come in and free his people, make him not have to live in secret and always fearing for his life. I mean, clearly the people have changed their opinion, or so it seems. Seems like the public opinion has decidedly shifted in his favor. So I imagine that Elijah is pretty excited, and he's ready to see something good happen in his country. But what actually happens when he gets back to town? Here's a quote. "May the gods strike me and even kill me if by this time tomorrow I have not killed you just as you killed them." These are the words of Jezebel, the queen, when she had heard how all her Baal prophets had been murdered. And after 3 years of living in exile, in poverty, coming back, standing fearlessly in front of the crowds, Elijah is completely despondent. All his hopes have been dashed in a moment. And what does he do when he hears these words of Jezebel? He quits. He runs away. He immediately heads south. He left his servant in Beersheba, which in modern English means he fired his secretary. You know, he's done. He's not going to do this prophet thing anymore. He's finished. He's going home or going somewhere, and he is not going to continue. So after he leaves his servant, he walks out into the desert. He prays to God. He prays that God would take his life. He prays to die. And so he's out in the desert. He falls asleep. He wakes up, and there's an angel there. The angel has baked him fresh bread. And he says to Elijah, "Get up and eat, or the journey will be too much for you." And so Elijah eats this fresh baked bread, and he walks for 40 days and 40 nights into the wilderness. And what does 40 days and 40 nights mean to us? What else is it, 40 days and 40 nights in the Bible? We got the flood, the rains of the flood, 40 days and 40 nights. Moses is on the mountain carving the stone of the law, 40 days and 40 nights. Jesus fasts for 40 days and 40 nights before starting his ministry. 40 days and 40 nights. To me, the only thing that's 40 in the natural world is what? What's the only 40 in the natural world? 40 weeks. 40 years. Yeah, this Sean, sorry. This is not a joke about your age today. The only thing I know of that's 40 in the natural world is a human pregnancy. It's 39 weeks. So it's basically 40 weeks. So I think the image here is something new is being born in the world. You know, it's a period of struggle and trials, but in the end, something wonderful, something new, something great is coming into the world. And this is what Elijah is going through as he's walking 40 days and 40 nights into the desert. So when Elijah, after 40 days and 40 nights, he arrives at the mountain of God. And you might remember the mountain of God is where Moses had received the Ten Commandments, where God had met Moses face to face in the midst of lightning and thunder and fire, wind. And Elijah reaches this mountain and he spends the night in a cave. And God spoke to Elijah in that mountain and he said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Elijah responded back to God. He said, "I have zealously served the Lord God Almighty, but the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down your altars, and killed every one of your prophets. I'm the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too." So what does this mean? I think this means that Elijah is all alone. He has sacrificed everything. He has worked with every fiber of his being. He has given up everything, and now he's failed. He's all alone, and his life is at an end with nothing to show for it. It's a sense of profound disappointment. I don't know if we have a good word for it. We'd have to use several words. But he is absolutely hopeless, and he's given up. So are we a little more relevant now, maybe, than Super Elijah? I know when I get to this point, I'm like, oh, Elijah, he's a real person. He's a real human being. And so God says to Elijah, he says, "Go out and stand before me on the mountain." And Elijah stood there before God on the mountain, and God passed by him. And there was a mighty windstorm, and it was so strong that the rocks were torn loose from the mountain. But God was not in the wind. And after the wind, there was an earthquake. But God was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, there was a fire, but God was not in the fire. After the fire, there was a sound of a gentle whisper. And when Elijah heard this gentle whisper, he wrapped his face in his cloak, and he went out and he stood at the entrance of the cave. And God spoke to him again, and God said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah replies with exactly the same thing he had already said. And I get the image of the prodigal son story where he's going back to see his father. And he's going to, you know, confess his sin to his father and see if his father might find a, you know, job for him somehow. And he's like rehearsing this, and he says this thing to his father. I get the kind of picture here that, you know, Elijah's been doing this. He's been rehearsing this for 40 days and 40 nights, walking through the wilderness of what he's going to say. And he says again, "I have zealously served the Lord God Almighty. But the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down your altars, killed every one of your prophets. I'm the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too." God answered Elijah and said, "Go back the same way you came and travel to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive there, anoint Hazael to be king of Aram. Then anoint Jehu, grandson of Nimshi, to be king of Israel. And anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from the town of Abel-Meholah, to replace you as my prophet. Anyone who escapes from Hazael will be killed by Jehu. And those who escape Jehu will be killed by Elisha. Yet I will preserve 7,000 others in Israel who have never bowed down to Baal or kissed him." What does this all mean to Elijah? I think it means, Elijah, you're not alone. You know, I'm giving you these co-workers to work with you. It is not all up to you. There are other people working on this. I'm working on this. My plans will succeed. And that's the end of the story. And I'm not telling you, or I haven't told you this story because now you will logically see that, oh, God is with us. God is taking care of us. God will make his plan succeed. God will take care of us. God will provide friends and family for us. I don't think that would work very well. That might work for a little bit. If I were a better preacher, that might work for a little bit. But I think what will work is if we follow the path of Elijah. Because I think we live in a culture, and maybe most cultures are somewhat like this, where we are encouraged to work frenetically, to never give up, to never quit, to never take a break, to depend on no one. And we want, you know, the Mount Carmel experience of, you know, success every day. And we don't get that, even most days, maybe. And sometimes we quit, and sometimes we fail, and sometimes we give up. Sometimes we run away. Sometimes we're depressed and anxious. Why did God allow this 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness? Is that efficient? Is that an efficient, effective use of time? Would he pass the CEO course? You know, I mean, at the beginning of this 40 days and 40 nights, Elijah's, you know, on the verge of death, you know, and the angel says, "Eat more food. Have some food. This is going to be a long journey." Why 40 days in the wilderness? Why didn't God just say, "Come on, Elijah, I'm here with you. There's other people going to work on this. You know, get back to work, slave," you know, which is kind of the Baal, you know, is kind of what Baal would have said. Why is Yahweh different? I don't know. Sorry. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know why we have to go through periods of time of suffering and depression and loneliness and all of that. But what I do know is that we need to follow the path of Elijah. We need to take our disappointments and failures to God. And I don't only mean to take them and say, "God, please help me." I also mean to take our complaints to God Sometimes I feel like we pretend to be thankful when we're not thankful. And when we do this, we're not following Elijah, we're not, you know, all the heroes in the Bible pretty much brought complaints to God. They brought their anger and their fear and their disappointments and their doubts. They brought it to God, and they were not, they were not timid, no. They were not timid. They were not shy about it. They were not timid. I guess that's the only word. I forgot the real word. But they openly shared what was in the depths of their heart, the deepest suffering that they were going through. And they did not always do it politely. Maybe they were impolite. Read Job. read about Moses. And so I think we need to pray those kinds of prayers. I think we need to pray to God, God, where are you? God, are you even there? God, do you care about me? Do you care what happens to me? And I think if we can pray these kinds of prayers, if we can go out into the wilderness, then I think we can travel that path of Elijah. I think we can go from disappointment and fear to hope. We can go from oppression to freedom. We can go from struggling faith, failure and doubt, to reach the Father's heart. And I would like to bless you in conclusion, because you've been a blessing to us. May the Lord bless you and protect you. May the Lord shine His face on you and be gracious to you. May the Lord look you in the eye and give you peace.